Welcome, everyone. You're listening to Horizontes, Latin America's Leadership Forum. Our focus is on providing you, the region's actual and future leaders, with the insights and skills that you need to succeed. I'm John Price, your host. Horizontes is brought to you by America's Market Intelligence, the leading market intelligence consultancy for Latin America, established over 30 years ago in 1993. Today, I'm blessed to be chatting with a remarkably dynamic entrepreneur whose name, I promise you, will one day become a household name across Latin America, if not further afield, Alejandro McCormack. Reading Alejandro's CV will make your head spin. Since earning a bachelor's degree at UT Austin in 2013, Alejandro has earned two graduate degrees, worked for merchant banks in Boston and London, and helped lead five different fintechs based in Europe and Central America. Raised by an Irish father and Salvadorian mother, Alejandro McCormack is married to a Latvian, and the two of them have raised their kids between Berlin and San Salvador. A more global citizen you will rarely find. I caught up with Alejandro from his home in San Salvador. We apologize for the recording quality that reflects the spotty nature of his local Wi-Fi. But despite the recording challenges, Alejandro McCormack's enthusiasm is indomitably infectious and matched only by the hard-earned wisdom of his thoughtful reflections. Enjoy. Alejandro, how great to see you again. It's been a while since we met in Guatemala. I hope you're well.
I'm well. Thanks a million, John. It's great to be talking again. It's certainly been a minute, but exciting to get to chat with you again.
Absolutely. So now I find you in San Salvador. Is that correct?
That is correct. Okay. Just four and a half hours from where we met in Guatemala City. So
That's right. So Alejandro McCormack is an unusual combination of names. So I wanted to ask you first about your own personal background. Your name sort of alludes to the fact that your father is Irish and your mother's from El Salvador. So I imagine you grew up in a multilingual household and certainly a bicultural household. And what was that like, and how instrumental was that in forging your career as you have done so?
Fantastic. No, so absolutely spot on. My father is Irish. My mother's from El Salvador. They met in the south of France. They made me in Amsterdam. So I've certainly been multicultural and been traveling a lot since I was very young. And that's definitely informed my outlook in the world. I'm very much global in how I think. I've been lucky enough to be able to pursue opportunities and not be limited by a geographic scope. I've worked in Germany, I've worked in the States, I've worked in Latin America, I've lived in Japan. And so I think that having that third culture kid, as people call it, being a third culture kid, it can be a superpower if you're able to harness it.
Absolutely. I think it's fantastic. I forgot to mention you're married to a Latvian and, as you said, spent a decade in Berlin. So that's a whole nother wrinkle. I empathize a little bit with that upbringing or that choice of life. I married an East German, and have spent a lot of time in Berlin as well. So it's great to connect with, as Mexico, they would call us bichos raros.
Exactly.
That name wouldn't work well, and I've learned in Puerto Rico, but
no. Mexico. It works well in El Salvador as well. My daughter actually looked at me the other day and said, "Papa, tú eres tan raro." So not sure how to take that, but I take it positively.
As long as she's not saying that when she's 25, you're good.
Yeah, let's hope.
Look, reading your CV, it practically gives me whiplash, my friend. Since you graduated from UT Austin with a BA a decade ago, you've earned two master's degrees, held two jobs in leading financial firms, and have helped lead five different fintechs. My God, what do you eat for breakfast? No, seriously, though. You know, the people who listen to this podcast are often in high-performance jobs, and When I come across someone like yourself who's able to manage all these balls in the air, I can't help but ask them, what are some of the personal habits that they bring to their life that enables them to sustain such a high tempo of work and lifestyle?
Yeah, so I mean, I wish I had a really clear-cut answer for this one, John, but I think it ultimately comes down to liking what you're doing, sometimes falling into things by accident and finding along the way that you're on the right path. I try to wake up early. I try to get some time in with my kids. I try to get some time in with my wife. I try to read as much as I can so that, my brain gets to sign off a little bit from all the work and stuff. But ultimately, I think one of the things that's informed my life path and my career has been actually the places that I want to live in and the type of work I want to do. I ended up in Berlin on a whim, trying to advance this blockchain startup back in 2014. It was early days for blockchain, and it was really cool to be in a city like Berlin at that time, looking at that type of technology. Learned a lot. It failed, like, long story short, but that's kind of the way that I guide the direction that I go in terms of how I approach job life balance. And be excited about where you live, be excited about what's coming up next, and make sure you're awake for it. Don't fall asleep at the wheel.
Absolutely. I think, it's good advice to young people coming out of school to follow your heart, follow your passion, do what excites you, not necessarily the practical approach. But
Absolutely.
maybe it works out to be practical as well, but make sure it impassions you. I think that's the key there. Now, speaking of that, you made the leap from a perfectly respectable career in high finance to a far riskier career in fintech startups. And I understand you were co-founder of Ticket Vault in Berlin. And what was the mission of Ticket Vault, and was it successful?
Yeah, so I think I kind of jumped the gun on that one.
Yeah. Oh, that was Ticket Vault. Okay, that was
yeah,
Ticket
that
Vault.
was Ticket Vault. But
Okay.
as you said, I was working at a pretty big asset manager in Boston, quite a very traditional. I think it's actually the oldest ever financial asset manager in the United States, Eaton Vance. And so it is just the epitome of traditional corporate finance. And it was, I realized quite quickly, this is not what I want to be doing. And it was a great learning experience for me. I learned a lot. I learned that I can execute at a high level. I can be with really intelligent people. I was lucky enough to have a really amazing boss. But I also realized, hey, I want to be doing something a bit more creative and where I'm having a bit more direct hands-on experience and direct hands-on impact in the world around me. And so I had the opportunity during my MBA, we got selected as my co-founder and I to go to an accelerator in Berlin and advance this little white paper that we'd submitted, which was around this first use case for a blockchain-enabled ticketing company. So we wanted to solve that problem of the resale market or control within the ticketing industry, which is huge. And I still remember the data point. This is like 10 years ago, but I still remember the data point that I would leave with in the pitch that, Beyonce, when she sells out a concert, that's only 30% of the transaction volume around that actual concert. 70% of it is resale that happens afterwards.
Wow.
And I think that's a really powerful data point. And that 70%, the promoter who took the risk, who booked this artist, doesn't actually participate in any of that. And I think that shouldn't be the case, right? And so that was a little bit the thought process around Ticket Vault. Also, the fact that myself, I love going to concerts. And it's happened to me where I buy tickets in the secondhand market and I'd go and my ticket would work, but my girlfriend's wouldn't, or my ticket would turn out that it was a fraud. And so these are terrible experiences because you're never more excited, or at least as a music lover, it's when you're about to go into the concert, you're there, you're wearing the funny hat or whatever, you're ready, you can almost hear the music. And then, oh, sorry, no, this ticket isn't valid. And so we wanted to solve that issue, which we view as a big one. It didn't work out. I think we were first-time founders. We were a bit naive about the approach. We wanted to really validate things from a business standpoint where maybe we should have just raised a big ICO at the time, looking back. And we but it was a learn quick experience. We failed fast, and it taught me what I needed. It taught me what gaps I had in my skill set that I should, what I'm missing is product management experience. And so that's what led me to my next job. I started looking through my phone. I thought, okay, where can I apply as a junior product manager or as a product management intern? What's an app that excites me?
And I'm thinking also, you brushed over I understand that you were at this high finance, this sort of very conservative, very traditional firm. But one thing that I imagine you picked up was how to speak to those people, how to dress for those people. What do they want to hear when they're considering investments, either for themselves or if they're private, capital on behalf of their clients? A lot of entrepreneurs are intimidated by it when they go after institutional capital, right? Because they don't know how to talk to those people. And the fact that you spent time with those people, I'm sure, had a really positive impact on your fundraising capabilities.
Absolutely.
Would you agree with that?
Yeah. Absolutely. I think, it gives you a certain confidence. You've been on the other side of the table. Even if it's maybe a different type of investing than the sort of investors that I approach now as a venture-backed startup, but it definitely lets you think about it from their perspective. Okay, what's the return potential? Market sizing, that's the key thing that I learned there,
right,
which every VC really hones in on, is what is the real potential of the market that this startup is attacking? And so that was for sure one of the things that's helped set me up for what I'm doing now, which is in large part fundraising. I need, that's the gasoline that startups need. They need that fuel to keep growing. So yeah, you hit the nail on the head with that one.
The Horizontes Leadership Forum is brought to you by Americas Market Intelligence, the region's leading consultancy and advisory firm, serving companies operating in Latin America and Caribbean markets for over three decades. AMI's vast network of consultants located in every major market in the Americas gather vital market intelligence from privileged sources that our industry practice leaders turn into insightful analysis to help our clients, some of the largest investors in Latin America, make vital business decisions. Before you decide to invest, launch a product, choose a partner, enter a market, or acquire a business, make sure your decision is an informed one. Find us at americasmi.com. That's AmericasMi.com. And now back to the Horizontes podcast.
After Ticket Vault came N26, right, which is also based in Berlin. What was, I know it was very high, very, very high profile fintech in Germany, if not in the European sphere. What was the N26 raison d'être? What were they trying to solve?
So they wanted to build, and they want to build a bank the world loves to use. I think that's still the slogan.
Okay.
Building a bank the world loves to use. And that's very much why I applied there. I looked at my phone, as I was saying, and I thought, okay, so what's an app that I actually enjoy using? And what irony that it's my banking app. Really, that's the one I was like, you know what? I've never been as excited about an app as I am about my banking app. That's weird. That's strange. So these guys must be doing something really well. I need to go and check it out from the inside. I need to go and see what's this magic sauce. Like, how can you get a person excited about opening their banking app? Because normally one is very weary of opening their app.
Oh,
so
yeah.
so
oh,
this
yeah.
is a, this is what
especially
one of the
banking
things
apps.
That I think they're doing. Yeah, especially banking apps.
How have they done, or rather, what did you take from that experience? It sounds like they've succeeded, and they've sort of climbed the ladder in terms of their fundraising and their expansion. What did you take away from that experience?
Absolutely. I think I was able to experience hyperscale, which is, that was a first for me, going from, I think there was 300 or 400 employees when I joined to over 1500 when I left. And that was in, less than almost a year, that's how quickly that change happens. I remember my first project was, hey, we're getting way too much contacts. They're contacting our call center. It's collapsing. We don't know what to do because we just have way too many users now all of a sudden. And so that translates at a certain time in a startup's scale up life into too many employees, too much customer service. And it was becoming an operational nightmare. It was becoming a problem that needed to be solved. And so, and that's the sort of things which you're not going to experience at a big established corporation. It's not the sort of stuff you're going to experience at a very early stage startup either. And so it really teaches you what's the skill sets you need in order to survive this hyperscale without falling apart in midway to orbit, right? And so, that's the main takeaway for me. It also allowed me to work with world class talent for the first, like truly world class tech talent for the first time in my life,
Right,
and that's something that I'm still making the most of today.
Yeah, I think that's, you know, for someone who comes at startups from not a tech background, I think that's a tough learning curve, right? To understand the difference between, because it's not, technology is so different than many other business skills in that you can say, okay, if they went to this level of a school and got an MBA, you can count on a certain level of business acumen. But on the tech side, they may be a genius who never studied in any kind of university, or maybe they went to a course and they might be pretty mediocre. I mean, that's got to be a tough thing to measure.
And it requires its own language. You were speaking about language earlier, right? About learning how to speak to investors. Speaking to tech talent, that's also a language, right? That you need to learn, you need to hone in, you need to hone it with time and experience, because they speak their own language, and you need to be able to meet on that level if you truly want to get the most out of product and engineering teams. And so that was a really great experience, and it allowed me that first touch with building products that the world is loving to use, experiencing product market fit in real time, because that's a feeling. It's palpable in the energy in a company. You can see it in the metrics. And when it's not there, I've also been at that point as a founder and as a startup, you can feel the missing element, right?
Right,
and so
right.
You know now what to look for. You know what you're seeking for when you start something of your own, or when you're working in a different place. You're like, okay, I'm looking for that feeling. I'm looking for these kinds of metrics, which validate that we're on the right path.
Amazing. Now, we talked about you being involved in five startups. Two additional ones were Raisin, where you were the country manager in Ireland, and then N1CO, which you were involved in when we met about 8 months ago, 9 months ago.
Yeah.
But I really want to talk to you about Abaco Capital, which is where you are today, and I know you're very excited about. Tell us about Abaco, what they're trying to achieve, what problem are they trying to solve, and how's it going so far?
Fantastic. So yes, absolutely excited to tell you about Abaco. I started Abaco a few months ago with a couple of co-founders, honing in on the problem of access to credit in Latin America, starting with this super underserved region of Central America and the Caribbean, which I like to think of as the final frontier, both for fintech and for venture capital. So, you know, we identified that there are millions of SMEs in this region who all lack access to recurring financial services, be it through lending, be it through services. And so we wanted to fix that mismatch in the market. Coming at it from a world-class fintech background, I've been at, as you mentioned, a couple of unicorns already, both, you know, Raisin and N26 are massive fintechs that everyone knows about. And my co-founder, Carlos, he comes from Zeppelin and Jeeves, two big Latam fintechs where he ended up growth. And so we kind of looked at this and said, hey, if we're good enough to do this on a global level, why don't we bring that skill home? You know, let's have an element of impact in the work that we're doing. And that's really what informed the decision to start Abaco.
Okay. And how you mentioned, you know, providing access to credit. And I believe that you probably have different ways of doing that, but one of them is factoring, right? So leveraging people's accounts receivable. So how are you guys, factoring's been around for a long time. Mm-hmm. There's, you know, banks do it, firms, specialized firms do it. What makes you guys different in the factoring space?
Super. So I think there's a couple of key differentiators for us. One is the market in which we're doing it, right? Where, yes, it's been around for a while, but it's kind of a forgotten-ish financial product in our part of the world here in Central America. And so we're kind of putting a new spin on it by making it 100% digital, which is another differentiator. And by bringing it to an underserved market, we like to call it the long tail supply chain. So the way that corporates manage their accounts payable is typically they have their top 20% of suppliers who they manage in a very strategic fashion. They get the best credit terms, they get paid first, and they're very essential to the corporation's health and success. And so they manage them very closely. But then there's the other 80% of their suppliers, and that's what we call the long tail of the supply chain. they do not have access to recurring financial services. They don't even have access to factoring service, even though they are also selling to these big multinationals. And so we view that as a really nice wedge to go in, help them get access to credit with a asset-backed type of loan, right? There's more security in a factoring operation than in just giving them a line of credit based on their sales or what have you. And so we view that as kind of, you've got to be safe when it comes to lending, especially in Latin America, where there isn't as much access to information. Credit bureaus are not as sophisticated as in other parts of the world. And so we view this as kind of an intelligent way to mitigate risk while also having impact.
And in terms of, you know, when you guys are holding the paper, the accounts receivable, explain what happens if, you know, your customer can't pay it back. How agile is the legal system in Central America that will allow you to then realistically collect those invoices yourself?
That's a good question.
What's the legal background that facilitates that?
So it depends per market, to be totally frank. In Nicaragua, for example, there is a very, very express process for executing what is known as a GEM, which is sort of this document which guarantees this debt. And that happens in less than 24 hours. In El Salvador, that isn't necessarily the case. It's a more drawn out, more expensive legal process. But we've hacked that a little bit. And how do we do it? We partner up with the corporations paying these accounts receivable. So our risk is more on the corporate side. And we have a contractual relationship with this corporate payer, which basically brings our risk down to zero. And it's also a distribution vector for our products. We get close to these corporates and we say, hey, listen, we'd like to implement this Pronto Pago program for your suppliers to help them get access to liquidity, to strengthen your supply chain, which in turn strengthens your corporation. And it's quite a compelling sales pitch. And they then give us access to these suppliers. And so that kind of has this virality effect where each corporate that we manage to onboard as a partner leads to thousands of new suppliers, which in turn lead to new corporates ad infinitum. And so this is a very nice commercial flywheel, which we're currently accelerating and also mitigates risk on the other side, which is the beauty of it.
That is, I mean, the fact that you've got those corporates doing your promotion for you is so helpful because, as you know, reaching SME owners are a skeptical bunch, right? So
absolutely,
any marketing messages often fall on deaf ears there. Now, speaking of that, you know, you have this remarkable fintech experience, a lot of it put together in Europe. The education levels in Europe, including financial education levels in Europe, are considerably higher, more sophisticated, particularly among a subsegment like SMEs, than you'll find in Central America. Also in Central America is the youngest demographic of all of Latin America. So this young demographic, this often financially unsophisticated level of knowledge amongst, even if they're savvy in many other regards of their own business, how do you adapt what you're doing to address that market? What are some of the things that you've had to change or dumb down or simplify or whatever the adaptation strategy is to deal with a very different reality of a marketplace in Central America versus Europe?
Yeah, so one clear thing we honed in on initially was the importance of transparency and clear pricing, which, you know, it sounds like kind of a classic buzzword that a lot of fintechs use, but in this market where you lack quite a bit of financial literacy or sophistication, as you said, it's even more important. So here in this region, the norm for factoring, traditional factoring companies, is they'll have a ton of hidden fees. They'll say, oh, we only charge 1% per month, but then there's a 5% fee on the disbursement of capital. Then there's another, you know, they basically package in a ton of hidden fees so that your effective rate is way higher than you think it is. And then there's a lot of surprises on the other end of that transaction. And We do it completely different. From the moment you onboard and you want access to credit, you know exactly what price you're going to be paying, and you pay it upfront. And so that's kind of one key thing where you address it. I don't want to say dumbing down, but definitely making it simpler for the customer. Another thing is meeting the customer where the customer already is. So I think that's really important in these markets. As you said, it's hard to get to SMEs. They have their own intricacies and their own way of doing things. And that was an unexpected realization. We had this hypothesis when we started Abaco that it was all going to be done through this web platform that we were building. And we quickly realized that we were catching a lot of growth in certain sectors, which we hadn't expected, like agriculture, for example. And there you have an even less financially literate population who nonetheless are selling quite a lot. They have growing businesses that need support. They need access to capital. But they are not going to take the time to stop and upload documents onto an online portal. They need it to happen on the fly. They need to be able to do it through WhatsApp. And so that's informed our product development strategy. We are now basically WhatsAppifying a lot of the product. So they're able to do it while they're driving their truck or while they're loading bales into the back of it. And so that's another way where I think we're meeting the market.
Interesting. Yeah, WhatsApp is... I think Latin America and India are sort of ahead of the rest of the world in terms of incorporating WhatsApp into small business, and that's very interesting.
The Horizontes Leadership Forum is brought to you by America's Market Intelligence. Each year, AMI's most senior practice leaders, led by your podcast host, John Price, are invited by over 50 conference, seminar, and private business meeting organizers to provide their insights, predictions, and opinions concerning the most pressing business trends and challenges of the day in the Americas. To learn more about how your next regional planning meeting or conference can be enhanced by a presentation from AMI's leadership team, visit us at americasmi.com. That's AMERICASMI.com. And now, back to the Horizontes podcast.
This approach, this transparency approach, this very honest approach, did you guys focus group that? So on the one hand, you know, how believable was that approach, first of all? And secondly, I imagine it creates some pretty happy customers when they realize that they're not, you know, that there isn't a secret phase two to their payment obligations. How do you leverage that happiness, that satisfaction into testimonials and getting that realization out to a wider space? Well, what are some of the tools you do marketing wise to leverage that? Because I imagine that when people realize that, hey, you guys are straight shooters, that's got to be a real big selling point.
Yeah, so I mean, that was definitely one of the hypotheses, right? But to be totally honest, there's a bit of a learning curve with that as well. You know, clients, in some cases, they're used to these old, I would say, twisted practices. And so on the face of it, they think, actually, wait, this is more expensive. I'm like, no. And so we've had to basically, on the communication front, on the marketing front, we have this comparison page that we use quite a lot where you can see, okay, this is actually how much you're paying with all these hidden fees. And this is actually how much we're charging. It ends up being cheaper. And so how do we basically use this as fuel for growth is we promote a lot of referrals. Like at N26, referrals were super key to some of the early growth. And that's something that I took to heart, and I've worked through and at Raisin and at different companies, and it's definitely something that we're leveraging very much at Abaco. Because if you manage to delight the customer, pricing isn't even that relevant. And I think that transcends to any product you're talking about. If you have a delighted customer and they evangelize about it, it doesn't really matter what the cost is. And so that's been very powerful, and we've seen how our happy clients lead us to other happy clients. They get a referral fee, a discount on their next financial operation, or a direct bonus in the form of a gift card or something. And so we're always thinking of new ways that we can incentivize our users to keep referring other potential clients. But the key one is making them happy, delivering the money quickly, being transparent about how we do it, being honest and fair in how we do the collections, and being understanding. Ultimately, in credit, you have to have a lot of empathy. You have to understand what these small businesses are going through and have certain flexibility, right? And you have to systematize and operationalize as much as you can, but you cannot lose the empathy on the way, because then you just end up being the same as the institutions you're trying to beat.
Now, you talked about the need to compare, and basically you're educating your client base. You know, they're accustomed to doing things one way, which has created enormous amounts of skepticism. And you are providing a different approach to things, more upfront, lower in total, but it requires an education. It occurred to me that, you know, one of the ancillary services probably provided for free is exactly that, financial education of your marketplace, that goes beyond selling your product into things like, you know, what are good practices? How much cash flow should you have to run your business? You know, some of the basic fundamentals of accounting, of good financial management, even of good marketing and promotional techniques. Is that something that you are providing or are thinking of providing in the future to sort of just, again, build this this good sense about your company and the fact that you're there to nurture SMEs?
I tell you what, John, we need to bring you on board to the team because you have it all mapped out. we're doing exactly that. And that is one of the key things we're focusing on, because we've realized that the more the customer understands the product and the more financially literate the customer is, the more likely they are to use it and to use it well and to use it successfully for the growth of their business and not to their detriment. And so early on, what we did is, and we're piloting this at the moment, we partnered with another small startup here in the region, which focuses exactly on that, on financial education for small, medium-sized businesses in the region. They basically give these SMEs access to certain learning tools. They have forums, they can ask questions, and they give them kind of this free consultation service. And so we basically bring them on board, say, hey, listen, we've got all these clients, they're using our product, help them use it better, right? Give them education, because we don't view short-term credit as where clients should stay forever. They create this credit history with us, and they should be graduating on. You know, they need to move on to longer term financial instruments. We'll meet them there eventually, but you know, that's a longer term plan. And so that's ultimately at the heart of what we want. We don't want customers kind of staying in the same loop.
Alejandro, Abaco is operating in how many markets in Central America, and how likely do you think, or how much of a market outside of Central America do you envision for Abaco or Abaco style services in the rest of Latin America?
So yeah, that's a good one. I mean, market size is always something that we have to justify as a Central America born startup. We're currently operating in El Salvador. We'll soon be launching our second market here in Central America. As to the broader opportunity, I think that there is a huge need for this across all of LATAM. You have certain markets like Mexico and Chile, where the type of solution which we're offering is already very advanced. You know, you have a couple of very well-funded players that are there, and there's a lot of depth in those markets. So they'll spend quite a bit of time taking up market share there. We view there as being a more acute need in this kind of frontier markets of LATAM, like Central America, which a lot of people dismiss it. But ultimately, if you look at it in as a whole, it's the third largest market in Latin America after Brazil and Argentina. It's larger than Colombia in terms of GDP, and so that's a compelling space. And then I also hone in on the Andes region, so Ecuador, Peru, Bolivia, and I view there as being a huge need as well there for the type of solution we're offering. There's already a couple of players doing similar type of services, but ultimately there is such a depth of need for finance in the region that I think that there's space for multiple players, and ultimately it's going to be about who does it best, who does it quickest, who can execute, and who brings that talent to the table.
Sure. Well, I don't know if it's public knowledge or if you can share it, but you know, having worked with IDB, IMF, World Bank, CAF in the past, they absolutely would love what you're doing. And I don't know if
Yeah.
you've tapped into those sources of capital, or if you find them to be sort of, challenging from a bureaucracy standpoint. But certainly the mission that you have, and I recognize you are a profit-seeking organization, but you are definitely making these societies more equitable by helping SMEs better compete. Have you tapped into that capital? Is that something you think could happen in future?
Totally. So we actually, when we started Abaco, yes, it is a capitalist endeavor, but it's also at its core an impact play. Like we very much wanted to impact positively on the lives of Central Americans, on the lives of Latin Americans who lack access to credit and thus lack access to opportunity to grow, to hire more. And so that's really why we started this. More than doing it because we wanted to build the next unicorn, we want to touch millions of SMEs. That's the main driver for us. We want to improve the way that they approach business and their opportunities. And so we've definitely been in touch with multiple of these multilaterals. And there's a lot of funding out there for the type of market that we're addressing or for the type of company that we are, given the markets we're addressing. They are a bit bureaucratic, I'll be totally honest, but I think BID, for example, the IDB, BID Lab specifically, they're the most active investor in Latin America, actually, as a venture capital firm. They basically do direct investment, they also do debt, and impact debt is one of the cheaper sources of funding in the region, and something which we would like to translate or basically pass on those savings to our more underserved clients. So we completely have it on the roadmap. We definitely are very aligned in that sense. We have not yet directly tapped those sources of funding, but we are already, let's say, we have a couple of venture capital funds that are funded by some of these organizations who are investors
Right.
in Abaco's cap table. So indirectly, they have helped advance our mission and our vision.
No, that's great. And that is, I think, often how they operate. They'll invest in funds who then are in a better position to do the due diligence and the selection process, which is, very, very cumbersome from their point of view. So,
Exactly.
now you've kind of alluded to, you said there was some Mexico is a deeper market in terms of the factory market, further advanced, Chile as well. Given the this problem across Latin America, the fact that traditional banks have not done a good job at looking after this market, the fact that there are people who are now finding business models like you guys, like Abaco, gave a big shout out to Abaco today at Visa Day in Peru, featured you guys in a presentation. But
Super.
how do you foresee this market consolidating over time? I mean, do you guys think you have the access to capital and you have the ability to scale up fast enough to start buying into your competition and absorbing your competition in Central America? Or do you foresee, sorry, in the Andean and other countries, or do you foresee you guys sort of building up a nice Central American business and then selling it off to a larger regional player or even a global player? I'm not sure how globalized a business this is and if they're well established in Asia or other parts of the world that are eyeing the market in Latin America. We haven't really talked about factoring beyond Latin America, but I imagine this is a issue that you'll find in other parts, other emerging markets around the world, pretty sophisticated players elsewhere as well.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think basically at the center of sort of what is the long-term vision for Abaco, we think both avenues are completely open to us. We could definitely be that player that grows out of its current region of operation and starts acquiring other businesses or just competing and beating other businesses in their home markets. That's definitely something which we're planning on doing. But along the way, there is the Central American story. I have a hypothesis or that Central America is going to see a lot more M&A than many other regions in Latam, bar perhaps Brazil. Because it is a very attractive market for acquisition. You know, your big players in Mexico, in the US, they eventually run out of space. You know, Mexico has multiple players now competing in the SME financing space, and they eventually get squeezed, right? They need to grow elsewhere. They need to look towards where are we going to acquire? And Central America becomes a logical destination. Likewise, Colombian groups, big South American groups, they start getting pushed up, and Central America becomes that nice addition, let's say, where you suddenly add seven or eight flags to your company in terms of where it's located just through one acquisition. And so I think that there's a very compelling medium term exit potential there. But I think the longer term vision is definitely to be a LATAM wide champion. I think we're able to do it. I think we have a globally successful team that's kind of proven that we know what we're doing, and now it's a matter of executing and really scaling it out. And I think that there is access to capital. I think one of the things which we couldn't have predicted when we first started this out was that private credit has become very popular. It's kind of the flavor of the month, I would say, and so that really helps us fund up our loan operations. It helps us fuel our growth. And so we definitely view us as we view it as possible to expand out very quickly.
You know, Central America is best kept secret in Latin America economically. There, it is by far the most stable economic region in Latin America. If you look at growth measured in dollars over the last 30 years, it is consistently outgrown the rest of the world, the rest of the region, and in its it has not suffered the same ups and downs that the rest of the region has done. And that's because its economies are underpinned by both exports and massive remittance inputs that just provide that dollar anchor to its economies that that nowhere else in Latin America can match. So I think, you know, to the degree to which, and I think, you know, the CAFTA agreement and other bilateral and regional trade regulatory agreements that have been signed over the last 40 years in Central America does actually, it is by far the most integrated block of markets in Latin America, much more than Mercosur, for instance.
Yeah.
I think, you know, and because Central Americans recognize that to make them interesting to foreign investors, they need to be able to offer one market. And so I think, yeah, it's, you know, it'll be fascinating to watch you guys and see if you end up sort of exiting as a Central American play to a Mexican buyer or even an international buyer, or if you, like you said, you have the talent and I think you have the chutzpah to grow out of Central America and take on even bigger markets. And that goes back to your experience and having worked in global markets and not being intimidated by, you know, the idea of buying a big player in Colombia 3 years from now. So I'm excited for you guys. I you know, as someone who studied SMEs for 30 years in Latin America, I know how desperate this solution is needed. There's no question. And like you said, it's just a matter of who gets there fastest with the best solution and has the right talent and the capital to back it up. So sounds like you've hit the jackpot here.
Absolutely. Thanks a million, John. And we need more true believers like you, people who understand the need in the market, the depth of this market, the potential that there is in this region. And because I think it's its moment to shine now. I think a lot of the factors you mentioned are spot on. And part of the reasons that we decided to pursue this venture now. And so we're also very excited about what's to come. We have a lot of very interesting milestones coming up. So happy to keep you in the loop and keep you informed going forward.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. And I wish you the greatest of success. I just, you know, it was a revelation to hear you speak in Guatemala, and it's just been a pleasure to watch your latest moves. And let's keep in touch. I wish you well. Definitely take a look at the Peruvian market. Judging on what I saw this morning in the conference, there's a real need for you guys. So I wish you all the best. I appreciate your time today. And we'll be in touch.
Super. Thanks, John. Bye-bye.
Take care now. Thank you for joining us for another Horizontes podcast, where we discuss key topics and challenges facing Latin American business leaders, featuring expert guests from a variety of fields and backgrounds. Horizontes is brought to you by America's Market Intelligence, the leading Latin American market intelligence consultancy. We gather the research, conduct the analysis, and form the recommendations in the bespoke fashion that companies require to make wise business decisions in Latin American and Caribbean markets. You can find Horizontes on all major podcast directories like Apple, Amazon, Spotify, and more. Or you can visit our website, americasmi.com, and look for Horizontes under the Thought Leadership menu.